I was in my first year of seminary when the call came. Not the call to ministry, of course. That one was already in full swing, as I had recently conceded that it turned out I wasn't just in seminary as a fun intellectual exercise. I actually was going to be serving a church. The call I mean actually was a literal call. It was Tuesday of spring break, and I had been napping with my daughter, who was then nearly 2.5. Or maybe I was napping and she was watching TV. Hard to say. Either way, I heard the phone ring in my slumber, but I let it go to voicemail. 20 or 30 minutes later, I wasn't done sleeping, but Gracie disagreed. And so we started moving around, and I went to look at the caller ID to see who had called. I thought I might recognize it, but I couldn't say for sure. So I called to listen. 9 years later, I can still remember the woman's voice on the recording, every pause and intonation. She said, "Hello, I'm calling from the Denver Department of Human Services. We show that over 2 years ago, you adopted the baby girl of," and then she said her name. "She's had another baby, a boy. Now, we don't know what will happen, but we're wondering if you would be interested in maybe a foster or adoptive placement. He'll be ready to come home from the hospital on Friday, maybe Saturday. So if you just give us a call back, we'd appreciate it." Now, I didn't want to say it in front of the kids before, but as I was planning about what I was going to say to them today, I realized that they don't know yet that that dread / excitement butterfly thing, that doesn't go away when you're done with school. It just becomes less predictable. Because when you're a grown-up, the sleepless nights and the deep breaths of terror and awe don't just come once a year in late summer and early fall. They can come anytime, all the time. And what's worse, there's no teacher around to help you know what to do or how to be. And even if your parents are still around, you've long since realized that instead of having some magical toolbox of answers, they are right there with you, wondering about that great spiritual question that seems to sum up life today. WTF. Which we all know means, well, that's fascinating. So, going back to the call, it's not that we hadn't thought about having another child. It's just that literally the day before, my partner had told me she was going to get laid off that next Friday. As in, like, 3 days later. Because the grant that funded her program had come to an end. And remember, I was in seminary, so my income was negative. I was actually not making money and incurring a lot of debt. And any savings that we had was quickly being depleted through the childcare for our toddler. Our not great sleeping toddler. Not just in nap time, but pretty much all the time, which meant that we were also exhausted, and our extended families lived far, far away, and we were already feeling like we were barely hanging on. Which means that, clearly, it would be a very stupid idea to say yes to that call. And at the very least, we should give it some serious contemplation. Think carefully about how it would all work, and if it was really a good idea, given everything. We should be realistic. And so I called the woman back and I got all the information I could. "He's 2 days old," she said. "He's 4 pounds, so he's tiny, but he's eating well and he's learning how to breathe. He was 2 months early. And they wanted to know if we would take him. They had given priority to us because we had his bio sister. But if we weren't up for it, they'd start calling others pretty quickly. So could I let her know in the next few hours or so?" Butterflies of terror and awe felt like they were bursting from every part of my body, and so I said, "Sure." "I just need to call Carrie. I mean, we should probably talk it over." She was like, "Oh, of course." I said, I'll call you back. So we hung up, and I called Carrie, and I told her, and she burst into tears. We can't. How can we? I mean, how will we ever manage it? I'm going to lose my job. We'll probably lose the house. We don't even know what we're doing with our one kid. How in the world? I didn't have the answers to her questions. I didn't know how it all would work. I didn't know hardly anything at all, except one thing. I knew who we were, in the big sense. I knew the kind of people and family that we wanted to be. So in response to her appropriate panic, I told Carrie, we have to go get him. He's ours. We'll figure it all out. He's Gracie's brother, and he's our son. We'll be okay. We just have to go get him. I'm pretty sure we kept talking until Carrie stopped crying. But I do know that by the end of the call, my clarity had become our clarity. And so I hung up and immediately told Gracie, thinking that it would be like the most mind-boggling thing she could ever hear. I mean, there's like whole books written on the subject, right? About how to tell older siblings that they're about to get a new child. So I thought, okay. Took a deep breath. I said, Grace, your baby brother is here. And without missing a beat, she said, I know, Mom. He's flying up above. Which I mostly think was toddler nonsense. But sometimes I let myself believe that actually in some mysterious and magical way, she already knew that this was the exact right next thing to happen. That instruction to do the next right thing is something that Glennon Doyle says often if you follow her writing or her blog posts. She is a recovering addict, but found the talk of taking one day at a time too big a bite of the unknown. Because life isn't made up of days or weeks or years. Life is a matter of choices, often small and fast and hidden, between friends and in families, over dinner and in the midst of a phone call on a Tuesday afternoon. The choices we make become the way we make our lives. And so her mantra is to stay focused on that next right choice, the next right thing, one thing at a time. The particular version of the instruction to do that next right thing that Sean read came to be one night after her three children were in bed, and she was alone, sitting on the bathroom floor. Just a few hours earlier, she'd been in another small room, and her husband was there, as was his therapist. There in that room on a regular day in the middle of her life, her husband confessed to her that for years, actually, since the beginning of their marriage, he'd been cheating on her. Upon hearing this, she immediately left the therapist's office and then proceeded to go through the motions of her day. She picked up her kids, she fed them dinner, she put them to bed, until finally she found herself on the bathroom floor, sitting there, and she was pretty sure that her marriage was ending. Their whole life, everything she knew and cared about was dissolving around her. All the what-ifs and the what-do-I-dos were hitting her because the kids were in bed, which meant it was quiet and nighttime, and she was alone with her thoughts, and especially that one big thought. The world, at least her world, was cracking open, pulling apart, and she couldn't see how she was going to survive. What was she going to do to make things right? Will things ever be right again? Many of us have been asking ourselves similar questions lately. What can we do to make things right? Will things ever be right again? Now, unlike Glennon Doyle's story, however, we can't point to a single revelation that brought us here. It's more like many new pieces of information, a combination of many things going on, maybe a constant stream of things that would be on their own earth-shattering shifts to absorb, but taken on the whole, engender a degree of overwhelm and uncertainty so pervasive that it's hard to even know what to be mad about or where to move forward. Will things ever be right again? Just in the past few days, we had the pardon of the sheriff, Joe Arpaio, and then the ban on trans folks in the military went into effect, all in the middle of the impending hurricane and that overarching realization that these extreme weather events are just going to get worse because climate change. And oh, it looks like North Korea has all the missiles. And again, this is like just the past few days. It's like way too much. Too much uncertainty and confusion and fear. It is no wonder we find ourselves metaphorically, okay, maybe literally, on the bathroom floor. This new reality came into view sometime around January for many of us. But actually, it's much older than that. While the pace of change has sped up in the last decade with social media and other technological innovations, I'd trace the new reality, this growing sense of uncertainty and change, back a few decades, maybe even 40 or 50 years. The current administration didn't invent this reality of uncertainty. They're just especially good at leveraging it to further their agenda. Which also means that the end of this administration won't be the end of uncertainty or multifaceted, quick-moving change. The world just doesn't unfold in a single linear way anymore. Or rather, we can no longer imagine that it unfolds in a single linear way because it really never did. One of the thinkers and activists that's inspiring me right now is the writer and healer Adrienne Marie Brown. Her book, Emergent Strategy, I'd like to swallow it up and swim in it all at the same time. It's so good. It is a handbook for how to deal with this reality of uncertainty. But before you go thinking that it's a step-by-step strategic plan of resistance, let me clarify that actually she directs just the opposite. Instead of working against uncertainty, she advises we lean into it. Feel all that's going on in all the places that are changing and learn from the patterns and new creations that are emerging. To imagine that each of these places of uncertainty and shift are also opportunities for something new to be created. Uncertainty, she reminds us, can be our friend. As we learn how to, quote, shift from a culture of strategic planning to strategic intentions. She says that although we can no longer count on the salvation of a master plan, we can still allow ourselves to be guided by our master intentions. Sitting on that floor that evening in terror and overwhelm, Glennon Doyle understood all of this exactly, that there could be no map, no big picture path that she could follow to guarantee her success because too much was shifting, too much was unknown, which she came to realize was actually the best news possible because that would mean that she really didn't know what was going to happen. And as long as she could remember what sort of person she wanted to be, and use that to do the next right thing, one thing at a time, she'd find her way home. Since getting the call a few weeks ago from Jennifer Piper from the American Friends Service Committee, which in this case the call was an email, about a woman who was seeking sanctuary with us, I've been having flashbacks to those calls that we received when we were waiting for our children. The call I described earlier because of the suddenness and the not readiness, but also the calls before that, especially the call even before Gracie, because we had to think carefully, not about whether or not that child needed a home. I mean, obviously they did. And definitely not about whether it was morally right to offer them a home. We were clear on that. Instead, we had to consider more specifically if the home they needed was our home, if the journey that they were on was the one that would become our journey. And of course, doing all of this was terrible speculation because there is finally no way to know, no rational, reasonable way to make that choice, because it's not about facts. It's about something else, some other sense, something to do with the people that we hoped to be, and something to do with my daughter's nonchalant understanding of her brother's obvious and already true presence among us. As we've gotten closer to the vote about sanctuary, and as the reality of providing sanctuary to someone who would otherwise be separated from her children, as this has sunk in, and as the power and privilege of being in this position has really hit me, it has often been completely overwhelming. Although I don't think I found myself on the bathroom floor about this particular issue, I may have said a few curse words here and there. Or at least it has been overwhelming whenever I started to think about the whole thing. And as in try to anticipate all that may come up, or ensure that we have a procedure, at least in outline form, if not in full sentences, for everything that might arise. It's like I was, using Sean's terms from last week, howling myself to death, which may be even worse than having somebody else do it to you. But when instead I go back to that big why, that question of what kind of people we hope to be and what our faith calls us to be, and I don't try to figure out the how for everything, but just the how of the stuff we already know, then it's not that hard. Because then I start to realize that even if we don't know all the answers right now, we're good at figuring stuff out. And since we are blessed with an uncertain world, the stuff that we know right now will be different before too long anyway, and we'll know other stuff instead. And that will give us new challenges, but also new opportunities. And because this is an uncertain and confusing world, knowledge and power is easy to share because it arises and is everywhere, which means we have more partners than we've ever had available to us. And these partners can do really big and important parts of the work, like give money or volunteer or send us notes of support and appreciation, like I've been getting from clergy and community leaders and citizens of Fort Collins this whole past few weeks. I can't answer for you, for this congregation, if this is the next right thing. And by this, I mean sanctuary, but also any other next right thing we might be contemplating. I can only promise that if it is, we'll figure it out. And I know this because my son, that little 4-pound shockwave, started fourth grade last week. Not everything has been easy in this path and without heartache, but what in life worth doing is. Now, you may know that the name Joseph, the name that we chose for him because I was finishing my Bible sequence, and I imagine that he might be like the brother at the end of Genesis, whose story started in tragedy, but resulted in a story of generosity and compassion. But this name, Joseph, it also turns out that it means God will provide. Now, before Joseph and before his sister, I'm not sure that saying this would have made much sense to me. God will provide. What? But then my kids and my ministry with all of you, it's helped me with the translation. Because I've seen and have personally experienced that sometimes, even a lot of the time, to be the person that you're called to be, you have to take a great leap of faith where you don't have all the information and the risk is high for getting your heart broken, but you do it because you know the sort of world that you want to help create. And the way, then in ways that you can't totally predict or understand, sometimes, a lot of the time, life responds in kind and provides. We don't have to figure everything out. And we don't have to make everything all better. We just have to do the next right thing. One thing at a time, and that'll take us all the way home. May it be so, and amen.
But I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard a living, but I'm afraid to die. Oh, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. I say, brother, brother, help me please. Oh, but he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I couldn't last for long. Now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
In 2012, I thought I had experienced heat. But that was all blown away when I arrived in Phoenix, Arizona during the month of June. It was 110 degrees. Just walking outside felt like most of your body's water just evaporated. I was going to my first experience of General Assembly, this gathering of Unitarian Universalists from around the country. And we had been called to go to Phoenix, not just to have a meeting, but to declare ourselves on the side of the immigrant and the refugee and the undocumented person. We all crammed into these yellow school buses and drove out of the city, thousands of Unitarian Universalists. And we were dropped off on this old country road, barely lit. We had these tiny little battery candles that were our only light in the dark. For we were standing outside the so-called tent city, this place where Sheriff Joe Arpaio was warehousing undocumented people on their way to deportation. It was still hot at night, and human rights organizations had told us that inside the tent city, inside the unair-conditioned canvas of this prison, it went up to at least 120 on some days. And I didn't have a lot of faith that our little vigil with our little candles would make a difference. But we stood on that road, and we sang, and we chanted, and we yelled to let the people know inside of this prison that there were people outside that cared. And on the little stage that had been erected, the now president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, the Reverend Susan Frederick Graves, stood up, and she had just gone on a tour with Sheriff Joe of this tent city, and she came out, and what she said to us was, "We could hear you. We could hear your song. They could hear you inside." Now, it would take 5 or so years of determined resistance for the people in Phoenix to finally unseat their sheriff so that he would no longer have the power that he did. 5 years of determined resistance and love and prayer, but they did it. Small actions. Small steps. Small steps towards what is right. We have those opportunities in our lives to make that next right step every day. And just one of those steps is presented to us each time we arrive at this church. Each Sunday, we have the opportunity to part with some of our gifts, so that our world may be magnified in a light of justice for all people. Today, the offering will be given and received and to support the work of Foothills and our immigration ministry. Because we know that no matter what happens with this vote, no matter what happens on whether or not we will be a sanctuary congregation in the sense of the word, we know that we are not going to give up the fight for a just immigration system in this country. Your generosity and gifts will now be most generously received.
One of my friends and colleagues, another Unitarian Universalist minister, she posted on her Facebook feed the other day that she was worried that every sermon that she came on Sunday started with, well, it's been a tough week. And so she asked that all of her friends, everyone who was in her feed, would respond with something that was bringing them joy. So that way she could enter her weekend remembering how much joy there is in this life, in addition to the heart. These things are all, of course, wrapped up together, but it's the joy that will carry us through, the joy that will help us get up off the floor and keep going. And it's the sense of gratitude for those moments of joy. So I invite us all to end our service today with just turning our attention to all those places in our hearts and in our lives that bring us joy. Small or big, the moments that fill you up, that keep you going. It doesn't solve everything, doesn't fix everything, but it allows you to keep going and to take that next step. So bring that into your heart and allow gratitude to fill you up. Just breathe into that gratitude and that joy for all the beauty of this life, the silly and the funny and the incredible and amazing. And when you're ready, I invite you to allow this feeling to let you rise in body or in spirit as we're going to sing together one more time. It's from the Teal Hymnal. The song that's there, it's listed as Standing on the Side of Love, but the composer asked us that we change the lyrics as he came to later to realize he felt like it needed to instead have the refrain answering the call of love. So we'll sing it like he's asked. With these words from the Unitarian Universalist minister Darcy Roque. She says, "There is too much hardship in this world to not find joy every day. There is too much injustice in the world to not right the balance every day. There is too much pain in this world not to heal every day. Each of us tends to a weary world. Let us go forth now and do that which calls us to make this world a more loving, more compassionate, and more filled with the grace of courageous love every day. Our worship time has ended. May our service begin. Go in love and enjoy. Amen.